This is podcast number 127. Thank you for joining us at Clinical Conversations, a podcast from Journal Watch, the medical research surveillance service whose website is jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. Danielle Schurer will join us next time. In this edition, we talk about multiple sclerosis and the costs of the newer disease-modifying therapies. The journal Neurology recently published an article on the cost-effectiveness of those drugs, and the findings were revealing. Using carefully designed simulations on a national database of more than 2,000 patients with multiple sclerosis, the study's authors concluded that 10 years treatment would result in about 2/10 of an added quality-adjusted life year, called a QALY, at an annualized cost of about $1 million a QALY. So the question arises, are these drugs and these effects worth the price? We're fortunate to have as our guest the paper's first author, Dr. Katia Noyes, Associate Professor and Chief of the Division of Health Policy and Outcomes Research in the Department of Community and Preventive Medicine at the University of Rochester School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Noyes.
Thank you very much for having me.
Have I summarized those numbers fairly? The drug benefits amount to 2 months of quality adjusted time in 10 years.
This is correct. And that health gain comes at the astonishing price of about $1 million per QALY. So it's probably not something that we can easily picture. What is the price per QALY? It really has nothing to do with the cost of medications, even though these drugs are very expensive. They cost about $30,000 a year. This price tag is really about gain in quality-adjusted life years and quality of life for these patients. So I hope your listeners can appreciate this number.
Well, you created a model in which pieces of that model were predicated on the patient's answers to questions about what they valued in life. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was a study done by another researcher, Dr. Lisa Prosser, a number of years ago, that she specifically asked patients with and without multiple sclerosis how they will value life with different symptoms associated with the disease.
And you open your paper with a quote from George Box, which I noticed as I was rereading it, which says that all models are wrong, but some are useful.
This is the saying I use every year when I teach my class on decision analysis and cost effectiveness, because not to say that modeling is irrelevant and not a serious science, but I hope people appreciate what we gain from modeling. The exact answers, the numbers of QALYs or cost associated with these QALYs, is not the most important contribution of these models. Prices change, the way how we practice medicine change, all patients are different, they have different insurance and different income. What's more important to me and to most researchers involved in decision analysis is to understand how these different factors are related. If we increase the price of medications, what impact would it have on health and economic burden of illness? If we reduce insurance coverage, what would that do? If we increase time in the nursing home or in acute care facility, the relationship between these different components of healthcare system and how they may play together, that's what we can gain from modeling. We can't do that in real life. That would be a tremendously expensive and probably unethical experiment on real people. And so the unique contribution of modeling is that allows us to play out different scenarios that we cannot try in real life.
Now, you focused in this study on multiple sclerosis, and what got you interested in that disease specifically?
That's a good question. It's not to say that the issue of high prices is unique to multiple sclerosis. Of course not. It affects all areas of medicine right now, some more than others. I got interested in this question for two reasons. First of all, my PhD dissertation was on multiple sclerosis, so I know enough about the physiology of illness and the unfortunate fact that we don't have a treatment for this illness. The other reason I was interested in MS is because this is somewhat unique illness that affects primarily younger people. It starts when people reach their 20s and 30s. So on top of healthcare costs, these people also experience a lot of other expenses associated with lost productivity, lost opportunities to complete education, excel their career, start a family. And these are the costs that we have a very hard time quantifying. Nevertheless, these areas of life are very important to patients. So if we can make improvements in other areas of their life, not only in healthcare, I would imagine that it will have a very important value to the society as a whole.
Now, you wrote that other studies in this area on these drugs didn't reach the same conclusions that you did. How does your study differ from those other studies?
I would like to clarify that a little bit. Mm-hmm. There have been a number of studies looking at cost-effectiveness of these medications, and the study has been conducted both by pharmaceutical companies and by academic group like us. And the conclusions vary based on who funded the study. And they also vary by a little bit by country and by what kind of population they included and how long they follow up on the patients. So there are a lot of factors that seem to contribute to the result of cost-effectiveness analysis. That's why we try to be very careful with designing this study. We want it to be applied to the current U.S. patients with MS under the current funding and healthcare system requirements and constraints, so that those parties, policymakers, health insurance executives, hospital administrators who are directly involved with making this kind of decisions will find this information useful to them and can successfully use evidence, and I think what we presented here is solid evidence, in order to make correct decisions for the patients and the populations.
You observe that unlike other industrialized countries, U.S. drug costs for these therapies amount to about 50% of the medical costs of the disease. And so you suggest that some therapies could approach cost effectiveness, could greatly come down from the $1 million per quality mark if the U.S. lowered its drug prices by about two-thirds. So that was a provocative remark. What's your feeling about the prospect of that?
I don't know if I should talk with you about it without my lawyer being here, but I'll try to stay as neutral as I can.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, this is a modeling exercise where we were trying to examine what kind of modifiable factors out there that could help us make these drugs more cost-effective. So obviously, we can't change effectiveness of these medications. These drugs, what they are, and clinical trials demonstrated their risk reduction and their impact on disease progression. Well, currently, we can't change that. What we can change are other factors. When patients start on the medications, and we also demonstrated that the earlier they start on these disease-modifying drugs, the more cost-effective the treatment is going to be. We showed that reducing price of these drugs could also give us a very significant reduction in incremental cost-effectiveness ratio to make it more close to societally acceptable standards. We talked about cost of long-term care, that it contributes a lot to overall burden of illness, and if things can be done about that, shifting from institutional care to community-based long-term care, that could be another solution. So that was really an attempt to find solutions, not necessarily singling out one or the other, but providing a menu of options.
In that regard, Dr. Noyes, the cost-effectiveness threshold in the United States seems to be somewhere around $100,000 per quality. At least that's what people say. Is that a fair characterization?
Most of the researchers in the cost-effectiveness and decision analysis arena will agree that cost-effectiveness threshold is somewhere between $50,000 per quality to $100,000 per quality. However, there is no single administrative body or any organization in this country that openly stated what the cost-effectiveness threshold is. In UK, for example, their National Institute for Clinical Excellence states in their policies and their recommendations what they consider as a cost-effectiveness threshold. It's about 30,000 pounds per quality currently. Many other countries, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, have their own cost-effectiveness threshold. U.S. doesn't, for many objective reasons. We don't have a single organization that monitors cost-effectiveness. Each provider, buyer, hospital, healthcare system are free to make their own decisions. The 100,000 is recommendations by researchers, and that's why in this paper specifically, we present results using a continuum of threshold value. That's one of the figures. So it allows any decision maker decide, depending on where they cut cost effectiveness, they can estimate how cost effective this treatment is going to be from their point of view. So it's a moving target.
Now, a lot of clinicians, I would imagine, and many of our listeners, see those letters QALY in a paper and say, okay, next slide, please. They avoid reading cost-effectiveness studies. And why do you think they're useful for clinicians to use or to understand?
This is a very good question. And again, every year when I teach my class, about half of the students are going to be practicing clinicians and half PhD students in health services research. And I can see how clinicians have a difficult time accepting the concept of cost-effectiveness, any policy-based or population-based research. And my explanation is that it's probably in conflict with what they've been trained in the medical school to do the best for the patient in front of them. Doesn't matter how many people are in line, doesn't matter how many other people in the community are suffering, let's do the best for the person in front of us.
Right.
And that's a great and honorable thing to do, as long as we can ensure that any patients will receive this kind of attention and this kind of unlimited resources. But we know that resources are not unlimited. And if we spend $1 million in one patient, we won't be able to do it for the hundreds or for the thousands of patients. So at some point, we got to start thinking about allocating resources and rationale of how we're spending limited funding, giving multiple priorities and multiple interests of different patient groups. And so this conflict between population interest and individual patient interest makes it very difficult to engage in cost-effectiveness analysis or assessment, which is done at policy level. It's not to say that patient Johnson shouldn't be receiving these meds. It's that if we give it to every single patient, we may not be able to give him anything else, or we may have to close a hospital next door, or we may not be able to offer immunization to children in need. What is the rationale? How do we allocate money? How do we fund one policy and not the other? We now have more treatments when we can fund. And so wearing this policy hat sometimes conflicts with wearing a physician hat. And that's where the struggle is, I think.
Uh-huh. Now, if clinicians are interested in coming to grips with cost-effectiveness studies or the concept in general, what are the things that you would say recommend to that your students look at the beginning of your course?
There are a couple excellent books and many more articles that have been written, and I would recommend two for people who are really interested. One is a recent book by Peter Newman, N-E-U-M-A-N-N. That's called Using Cost-Effectiveness Analysis to Improve Healthcare. And Peter is a professor at Tufts, an expert in cost-effectiveness research, who wrote very interesting, very insightful papers and essays about why we're not using cost-effectiveness and how could we incorporate it better in our healthcare system and policy. And I would recommend his books or any articles by him very highly. And the other book that I use in class, it is a Bible of cost-effectiveness research in the U.S. called Cost-Effectiveness in Health and Medicine by Martha Gold, Joanna Siegel, Louis Russell, and Milton Weinstein from Harvard. And this is a 1996 book, but it gives a very good foundation of the key principles and assumptions of cost-effectiveness research. And I am sure that it will help a lot of people to break down their fears of cost-effectiveness as rationing mechanism and lots of other negative images that this type of evaluation is associated with.
When our clinicians are talking with their patients, Is there something that they should be keeping in mind, do you think, as they're trying to explain the treatments that are on offer and what may or may not be useful? Are there things that people could use in the patient interview that you might suggest?
This is a great point that you're bringing, that many physicians and many patients may be hesitant to talk about and this is what we call cost-associated non-adherence. How often issues of financing and inability to afford medication may impact treatment. Addressing that may not be always easy. People may shy away from this kind of conversations, both physicians and patients. But I think without understanding that there is an issue, it would be very hard to achieve the high quality of care that we're striving for. And on top of that, there are resources available to help patients who are struggling to afford medications. Most of the pharmaceutical companies now have plans and subsidies and subscription plans, and there is Medicare Part D insurance available for elderly patients who need drug assistance. There are options. So, but recognizing that there is a problem and finding solutions for this problem, I think the first thing that physicians could do if they suspect that financial barriers may impact patients' ability to receive care.
That's good advice, Dr. Noyes. I want to thank you so much for discussing your paper with us today.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Well, that was Opus 127. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Scherer, thanks for listening.